Today is April 15th, 2012, and Sierra Community Church Pastor Noah Largent preaches part 14 of our series on Mark, Healed to Go Home. Noah Largent.
All right, we've been working through the book of Mark. We're into chapter 5, and one of the things we've been doing is to help us kind of go through the setting and get it set up as we've been having people read for us. And I thought, you know, gosh, what if we got somebody different to read? And I thought, what if we got just the best looking babe we could have come up here and read? And after I found that girl, and she's a babe, the thing I found out is, man, she is sharp too. So I'm going to have this girl, Heather, come and read for us today.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's hard enough to get up here, and then you have an introduction like that. All right, we're reading from the book of Mark, chapter 6, verse 1 through 20. So they arrived at the other side of the lake, in the land of the Gerasenes. Just as Jesus was climbing from the boat, a man possessed by an evil spirit ran from a cemetery to meet him. This man lived among the tombs and could not be restrained, even with a chain. Whenever he was put into chains and shackles, as he often was, he snapped the chains from his wrists and smashed the shackles. No one was strong enough to control him. All day long and throughout the night, he would wander among the tombs and in the hills, screaming and hitting himself with stones. When Jesus was still some distance away, the man saw him. He ran to meet Jesus and fell down before him. He gave a terrible scream, shrieking, "Why are you bothering me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you before God, don't torture me." For Jesus had already said to the spirit, "Come out of the man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked, "What is your name?" And the spirit replied, "Legion, because there are many of us here inside this man." Then the spirit begged him again and again not to send them to some distant place. There happened to be a large herd of pigs feeding on the hillside nearby. "Send us to the pigs," the evil spirits begged. Jesus gave them permission. So the evil spirits came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the entire herd of 2,000 pigs plunged down the hillside into the lake, where they drowned. The herdsmen fled to the nearby city and the surrounding countryside, spreading the news as they ran. Everyone rushed out to see for themselves. A crowd soon gathered around Jesus, but they were frightened. When they saw the man who had been demon-possessed, for he was sitting there, fully clothed and perfectly sane. Those who had seen what happened to the man and to the pigs told everyone about it, and the crowd began pleading with Jesus to go away and leave them alone. When Jesus got back into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go too. But Jesus said, "No. Go home to your friends and tell them what wonderful things the Lord has done for you and how merciful he has been." So the man started off to visit the 10 towns of that region and began to tell everyone about the great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed at what he had told them.
Thanks, Woody. Dan said it's nepotism to have my wife read. Great story here, and you know, we could divide the story into three parts and talk for, you know, we could talk extensively about the three different people here, about the man who's influenced by the demon. We could talk about the townspeople, and then we could also spend time talking about, you know, everybody's reaction within the story, the demons also. But I'm going to do my best to kind of run through all three of those groups of people in one fell swoop here, and see what we can learn for ourselves living here today, 2,000 years after this event took place. So first, let me set the context for you. I'm going to show you a map just to kind of give you oriented with where Jesus is during this part of his ministry. So this is a map of sort of what you look at the land of Israel. You know, one of the things I saw this week when I was looking at the land of Israel, you know, it seems like not a week goes by you don't hear something about the news of the things that are going on in Israel. And so I was looking at the square mileage of the borders of what Israel is. Israel is about half the size, less than half the size of the state of Florida. Is that crazy? And yet the world's attention just can't get off the events that have happened there over the last thousands and thousands of years. It's amazing. But this is a map of that area and where Jesus is. And this is where primarily most of what we read about Jesus' life takes place up in the northern part. Now, this is Jerusalem is actually south, quite a way south from here. But this is the area of the Galilee up there. And that lake up there is called the Sea of Tiberias or the Lake of Galilee. And Jesus does most of his ministry up in that area. In that area of that town of Capernaum is kind of the headquarters of that. But most of his ministry happens in the northwest corner of that lake and to the regions to the stretching out to the west of here. Now, what's interesting about this is as you look here, zoom in at the map here, the X sort of marks the spot where this story takes place, though. This is at the southeastern part of that lake. Now, this is if you and I are going, well, you know, Jesus traveled around, he went to a lot of places, right? And we don't really, you know, it doesn't stick out to us. And this area is called, south of here is called the Decapolis. There's 10 cities right there. And the event happens in one of these, and we're not quite sure because there's three cities that have very similar names. We're not exactly sure which one it is along the coast of the sea there. Here's the thing, though. If you were a Jewish person and you were reading this story, you would go, what is a good little Jewish rabbi and his students doing on that? And they would have said it like that. That side of the lake. You know, sometimes I hear people talk about living in Tahoe, like Tahoe is the jewel of the world, and they'll talk about those people. You know, John, he lives down in Gardnerville, down the hill. And, you know, we live up here, God's country, beautiful, right? And, you know, I've experienced that, especially when I lived in Monterey, people were like that. Yeah, people lived over in the Central Valley. You know, we lived in Monterey. And that's how it would have been here. The Jews would have gone, what is he doing on that side of the lake? Because the Jews all lived on the other side of the lake, and no Jews lived on the other side of the lake, and no Jews went to the other side of the lake, not to vacation, not for any reason, because those people were unclean. You didn't want to have anything to do with them. So the very fact that Jesus is over there is really, really odd, and we'll talk about that more in a couple of minutes here. But all of this is I want to put this all, there's the land where this all happens. But here's the thing, I want you to remember, this story happens in a series of four stories where Jesus is starting in the middle of chapter 4, where Jesus is bringing relief to desperate people who are in a bad situation and they really need help, serious help. And Jesus brings both relief and restoration. The first one that John talked about 2 weeks ago primarily was this storm, and the disciples there freaked out, right? And they can't even believe that Jesus is sleeping in the front of the boat. And when Jesus calms the storm, what's interesting about that is, remember their reaction? They were like, oh, praise God, you're wonderful. They're freaked out. Who is this guy that even the wind and waves obey him? This story is about Jesus who goes and visits this crazy guy. He's cutting himself. He's naked, living away from everybody else out in the tombs. And then the next story that we're going to talk about next week is about this girl. She's dead, and her father, Jairus, comes to get Jesus and believes that Jesus can raise her from the dead. And then along with that story, in the middle of that, is this story about this woman who's been subject to bleeding for years. All four of these stories are all about desperate people who need relief, and Jesus brings restoration to them when they cry out and they're most desperate in need of help. So in this story, there's these three people that we're going to talk about today. The demons, the town people, and the man. And so each one of them, there's three people, and each one of them has a reaction to Jesus. Each one of them has a request, and Jesus has a response for each one of them, and there's something we can learn from each one of those things. So let's walk through this together. First of all, the demon, and it's interesting because it's both called a demon and demons in here. There's both plural and singular in the way that it's worded in here in the Greek. It's really interesting. You would think that when Jesus gets off the boat and he comes over here, you would think that if there's any demons there that know who Jesus is, that what would they do? They would go, well, I'm out of here. We're going as far away from this guy as we can get, right? What's interesting, though, is they don't do that. In fact, they come out towards him, and they are scared to death of him. Their reaction when they find out Jesus is there is they are scared. What's interesting about this is, what do they say? Don't torture us. Isn't it interesting that the evil spirits know what's in store for them when Jesus comes? And they will. I mean, this is the interesting thing about this. It will not end well for them. But this is not the time where the end is going to happen for them. You can read in the book of Revelation, you can see that they will not have a happy ending. And they seem to know this. And so they beg Jesus, don't let this be right now. For whatever reason, they have an attachment to this area. They don't want to leave, but they don't want to be tortured by Jesus either. They know his power. They have a sense of who he is. Of course, almost every time Jesus encounters these evil spirits, they know who he is. They have an interesting request for him. Because they don't want to leave the area, they beg him. And you'll notice in here that everybody seems to be begging Jesus because they know that he has real authority and that he controls. The situation really isn't in their hands. When they're face to face with Jesus, they know the person who's got all the cards is before them. And in all of these cases, they beg him, don't send us away from here. Send us among the pigs. And Jesus's answer to that is he grants their request. They want something, and Jesus gives it to them. They go into the pigs, and these pigs run off this cliff into the lake, and they drown themselves. The people there were obviously not happy about that because the pigs were their source of income. This was their money, right? That's the bad part of the story. The good part of the story is that the removal of the demonic influences in this guy's life brings restoration and renewal to his life, but it comes at an economic cost to other people that are there. Well, let's look at the town people. How do they react to all of this? When they see Jesus, when they find out what Jesus has done, you might think, well, they'd be like, oh, how cool is that? This guy who's been terrorizing us, this guy who's been alienated from us, he's in his right mind, he's fine. Whoa, what an amazing guy Jesus is. And their reaction is very, very different than this. They too, just like the demons, are afraid. They are freaked out that this guy Jesus is there. What's interesting about this is one of the things you find out is if you're a careful reader of this stuff, you come to understand that, you know what, this is the response. Everybody, you know, we think, oh, Jesus, nice man, glad to have you in town. Do you notice that whenever Jesus is around, people are scared? You go back in just these couple of stories right here. Back in chapter 4, where the disciples are on the boat with him and the lake is calmed, they're terrified, man. This is his best friends. They're terrified of the guy and his power. Whoa, this guy can do whatever he wants. And it scares them. They don't know what to do with this. This guy, the demons, they're scared of him. We'll find out in the story that the people in this town, they're afraid of him. We find out in the next week, you'll find out about this woman who is desperate to receive her life back and get her health back, and she gets it. And when Jesus confronts her, her reaction is an, oh, great Jesus, thank you. She's terrified, it says, when she finds out that Jesus' power has healed her. She's scared to death of this. Why is this? Why are people, when they come face to face with Jesus and his raw power, his raw authority of control of everything, why do you think people get freaked out? Well, at least part of the reason, I think, is what C.S. Lewis in the Chronicle of Narnia illustrates so well about Jesus, who is in the Narnia series. He's the lion. And Lucy is having this conversation with the beaver, and if you've seen the movie, it's in the movie also, but it's a phenomenal, long, drawn-out conversation that they have, and it's worth reading. But she asks the question, you know, isn't he safe? And Mr. Beaver says, who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. There's a book that Josh Bowles and I have been reading, going through together here, by this guy named Shane Claiborne. And one of the chapters in there, he talks about how Jesus ruined his life. He went from a very typical white middle-class life in Southern America, from a well-to-do family and had a great future. He was a smart guy. He had good, very good social skills. And when he comes face-to-face with Jesus, and he's pursuing the American dream, and he comes face to face with Jesus, and he finds out that it very well may be that Jesus isn't after the American dream. And all of the things that America promises may not be the things that Jesus wants for our life. And he talks about how when Jesus comes into his life in a real way, and here's the thing, when he opens himself up to experiencing the power of Jesus in his life, his life gets turned upside down. And you know what? I do think that if you're honest with yourself, we do so much in our life to protect ourselves, to make life the way we want it to be. And here's the thing. If you open yourself up to the raw power of God and allow him to drive and direct your life, he may take your dreams, hold you upside down by your pants, and shake you like this until there's nothing left of what you wanted in life. And everything that he wants for you very well may be very different. But here's the thing. I'm not sure that you can experience God's real power, and you certainly won't have him as the authority in your life if you don't let him take you upside down and shake you. Anybody in here say that's not a scary prospect? You bet it is. What's the thing that everybody hates? What's the thing we protect ourselves against? That's why we have 401ks and all of these other plans that we have for our lives, because we want to know what the future holds. And if you surrender yourself to the authority and the power of Jesus, you don't have any idea what he might do with you. And I don't know anybody that wouldn't say, that's a little unnerving. And see, that's what happens here with these people. Everybody comes face to face with God's raw power, and they realize, you know what, in the end of the game, no matter how much I think I'm in control of things, there is someone who really is. And what happens is that sheen, this pretend life that we have of, I'm in control, I make the plans, I determine what I'm going to do, that veil is ripped away, and you come face to face with power and awe of the one who really is in control of everything. And man, that's unnerving for people. And I understand why that is. Have you ever seen the bumper sticker? You know, people say, God's my co-pilot. One of the things I want to pull up next to people, hey, unroll your window. If God's in the passenger seat, I think you might be better off with him driving, actually. You know, that's the way it's supposed to be. But we would love to pretend that we're really in control of things. And when we realize we're not, man, that is reason to be afraid. And the funny thing about that is you might find that it's the most freeing thing in the world, too, to walk away from that false sense of security where you really think you are in control and come to grips with God is anyways. So their reaction to him when they find this out is they plead with him also to leave. They say, hey, don't stick around. Please get out of here. We're not comfortable with you being here. Jesus' response to them is very interesting also, and he says to them, he says, all right, I'll give you what you want. And he gets in the boat and leaves. Now, here's the thing. Can you imagine this? If the story of the Bible was real to them and they realized that this was God's salvation for their life, what did they just do? They said, we don't want anything to do with you. Please go away. It's too scary. This is a story that happened 2,000 years ago. Do you think it's plausible that maybe people today might have sort of a similar experience in their life? Where they come to a place where they realize that Jesus is going to turn their life upside down and they're afraid of that? And what do? They say, please go away. Do you think that it's plausible that this maybe is not just a story about 2,000 years ago, but maybe this is what life is like today for a lot of people? I think that very well may be. What's interesting is I read this really interesting quote this week that has a parallel to this story about what happens, about the real cost of allowing ourselves to be open to the influence of God's power and authority in our life. And I'm going to show you this quote from this guy, Calvin Stowe, and you may not know who that is. I didn't know his name either until I'd read about him years ago, but forgotten all about the story. His wife was Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and obviously the most influential published book ever until that time when it was published, not only in America, but overseas as well. Well, her husband was a pastor and a preacher, and so to get away from the press and the press of people around her, after a number of years, they went over to England, and while they were there touring around, and he had the opportunity to do some preaching. And he runs into these people who are very, you know, on they say they're passionate about God. And here's the thing. As you read this quote, I was thinking about how sometimes I think that there's this false sense of security in our own lives where we go, oh, you know what? I prayed a prayer a long time ago. I prayed to ask Jesus into my life years ago. And there's a sense of security that we have with that. Maybe you might say, well, I go to church every Sunday. And that brings a sense of security, or like, I'm good with God because I've checked my box that he asks me to. And this quote really reminded me that, see, allowing Jesus' influence in our life isn't something you do once and then you're done with. You don't ask him into your life once and then you're all done. This is why Jesus says, pick up your cross. How often does he ask us to pick it up? You know this passage, right? Jesus doesn't say, you did it once, now you're done. It's a daily decision to be committed to allowing God's authority and his power to be invested in our life, to experience all that it means to walk with him in our lives. And so he's in England, and he's preaching to this crowd. And this is, so Calvin Stowe toured England, and he preached before a large crowd gathered to observe Anti-Slavery Day. He told the listeners in no uncertain terms that they were hypocrites. Now, England had expelled slavery long before we did. They got this right a long time ago. They were proud that slavery had long since disappeared in England. But 80% of the cotton picked by slaves in the southern states was bought by England. He said slavery would die in America if England would boycott its cotton. And he went on to ask, are you willing to sacrifice one penny to do away with slavery? And the crowd did what? They booed him. They did not like that. Why? Because what he was saying is he's saying to them, you know, to bring renewal to other people in the world, to allow other people to experience God's renewal and restoration in life. Sometimes, if you're going to be the vehicle of bringing that into the world, it's going to cost you something to do that. And it may make you uncomfortable in doing that. And see, this guy Garland, referring to this quote, he says, bringing healing, bringing compassion, and evangelism, they all have their costs. And many people don't want to pay it. See, this is if we are going to be God's agents in the world, if we're going to allow his power and authority to thrive in our lives, and we're going to bring restoration to the world the way God desires, it means yielding to him, and it may cost you something. I love this last sentence here. Perhaps people fear that they will be healed at the expense of losing more pigs. Oh, isn't that interesting? Why did those people send Jesus away? They had already lost something for somebody else. This other guy got healed. And the trade-off was they lost their pigs. They didn't want to lose any more of their economic security at the expense of having Jesus around. That was not a trade that they were willing to make. And that's the thing. It may cost us some things that we hold very dear in our lives. But what if we look at these things and we go, well, they're just pigs, man. Big deal. Look at what it got. But you know what? Are you ever fall into that trap of your own life? You're holding on so tight to whatever it is that you think life is about. And that becomes the thing that you're holding on to, and you're not willing to release your grip on it. And you know what you end up finding out about that? You're enslaved to that, and that's what really owns you. See, one of the things that I'm convinced of is people come to church and they go, you know, this whole Jesus thing, it's nice. But you know what? I can be good, and I don't really need God. I don't really need to be committed to him. You know, I can have God, but I'm in control of my own life, and I can do my own things, and I can be good on my own. You know what you find out in life? I've never met anybody that isn't controlled by something. We're all controlled. We're all owned by something. The problem is until we get really desperate, very oftentimes we don't ever figure out what it is that really owns us, what really influences us, what really controls us in life. And until we get really, really desperate, see, what's the thing that all of these stories have in common? When are the people willing to let go? When are the people willing to take the risk of allowing Jesus' influence and power to be exhibited in their life, when they're desperate, when they're at the end of their ropes. And see, that's when people really do come to find out, I don't have control, and whatever I'm holding on to really doesn't offer me the control or the peace that I want in life. And the sad thing is, a lot of us don't ever reach the bottom of that barrel to come to that place where we realize, maybe I can give this up and give of God my life. And I can allow his influence and his peace and his authority to guide me and drive me. Well, then we come to the man in this story. And the man, what's his reaction to all of this after he experiences all this? He rejoices, man. He's thrilled about this. He's got his life back. Remember, he's naked. He's out living away from, he's totally alienated from everybody. He's cut. He's bleeding. The guy's in desperate shape. And Jesus has given this guy his life back. Wow. Well, what's his reaction to this? He realizes what Jesus has to offer. And it's more attractive to him than anything else. This guy, there's nothing that has a hold on him that he wants to go back to. He just wants to go with Jesus. Now, here's the thing. I can't help but wonder, why didn't Jesus think to himself, this, if I collected all these people that I've made better, what an amazing dog and pony show I could have, man. You talk about a cool way to attract attention everywhere you went. Look at what I did, right? And what an amazing symbol of his power he could have if he took this guy with him. So remember, the demons, they had a request. Jesus gave it to him. Go into the pigs. So don't you want to stay in the area? Fine. The townspeople say, we don't want you here. Jesus knows what he can give them. But they say, leave us alone. He says, all right, I'll give it to you. This guy, he begs Jesus, let me go with you. And you think, it's a win for the guy. He gets to be with Jesus. It would be a win for Jesus. He gets to have this guy with him, traveling around. And what's Jesus say to him? No, you can't come with me. I'm sure the guy said, wait a minute. The demons got what they want. The townspeople got what they want. But me, I don't get what I want. And I'm the one who wants the good thing here. Jesus is always, you know, Jesus is, one thing you can say, he's never doing what's expected, is he? He's always, you know, in all of these other stories where Jesus makes people better, they want to go and blab about it, and Jesus says, shh, don't tell anybody what I just did. The demons yell and scream, and Jesus goes, quiet, don't talk. This story, what does he do? The demons want to talk, he lets them blab, right? This story, the guy wants to go with Jesus, and Jesus says, no, you go and tell everybody. I'm confused. I thought you said, Jesus, don't go tell anybody. Jesus tells this guy, go back home. Go to your town. Tell everybody what you've experienced. Now, part of this is this, the key to this whole thing is Jesus is working in an area where he rarely went to. And these were people that didn't have the sort of opportunities that all the Jews did to understand who he was. And Jesus says, hey, the most important thing you can do for the kingdom of God is go back home. One of the things that commentators talked about, and I'm not sure that I agree with them, is they talked about, well, what a nice thing. The guy's healed and he gets to go back to his house. I think this very well may have been the reason he doesn't want to go home is because he doesn't feel like he has anything to go home to. He's probably been alienated from people for so long that, you know, his first inclination is saying, hey, I'm good. I don't have anything to go back to. Let me go with you. I think it was probably a really hard thing for this guy to go back home. If you've been alienated from your family for whatever reason, do you ever just walk back in? Have you ever heard anybody just walking back in the door and everybody goes, hey, great to have you back. We'll just overlook all that stuff in the past that alienated you from us. It doesn't happen. I mean, it's a huge challenge for people who are alienated from any kind of community to come back and be restored into community. It takes tremendous work, doesn't it? See, this is the thing about being a Christian that I think is so true about this passage. When Jesus comes into your life, he doesn't come in and rescue you from all your problems and then send you away to go live somewhere else. He doesn't tell you, go to church and disown all of your old friends, you know, disown all the people that didn't like you, go and find a whole new group of people. Jesus doesn't tell us to do that. He doesn't tell us to escape our lives. Jesus says, take who you are, take the renewed life that I've given you, the restoration that you've experienced with God in your life, go back and work to bring that kind of restitution and that resolution to your other relationships. Don't go run and hide from them. That is a tremendously challenging thing, isn't it? In fact, I'm not sure in all of life that there's anything more challenging, which is why there's so much brokenness in life, because nobody wants to do that. Things get hard, relationships get hard, and the easiest thing to do is just quit on them and go away. And that's just not what Jesus encourages us to do. One of the things that I absolutely love about this church is I go other places and people, other pastors and other people ask, what's your church like? And, you know, people go, what's going on in your town? And, you know, because we live in such an entertainment-driven economy here in Tahoe, we have a lot of people that work at bars and casinos and in the entertainment industry. And people go, you have bartenders in your church? Well, God doesn't want to have anything to do with bars. People go, you've got people that are dealers in casinos? Casinos are the most evil places in the world. God wouldn't want you to have anything to do with those places. And I kind of scratch my head and I go, I'm trying to figure this out. And it seems to me that when I read the Bible, what God tells us to do is be a light in a dark place. So wherever you are, whether you're in a casino or you're working at Raley's or wherever you work in life, you have opportunities. And we're not supposed to run from hard places to easy places. You take Jesus with you wherever you are and you live out his purposes and plans in your life. You surrender yourself to his authority. And when you do that, the amazing thing is you can experience his power in your life in life-changing ways. And God uses you very oftentimes to bring the result that Jesus gave these people, you can help bring to other people in their life. That's why we don't run, we don't quit. We do what's hard, and Jesus asked this guy to do something very, very challenging. What's all this got for us? Well, there's a couple things that are really interesting in here that I think are worth exploring. Number one is, you might, in this story, one of the things we come to find out about Jesus is, you know, there's more than just the material limits of life. There's this whole spirit realm out there of these things going on and these spirits that have influence. And, you know, when Jesus is around, you become starkly aware of that stuff. But I think most of the time we're just sort of, we're material people and we think materialistically and, you know, physically. And it's hard for us to understand or think that there's this whole nother realm of things and world that we live in that are going on. And Jesus brings us into stark reality. I went and saw this movie 2 weeks ago with some of my college 20-something people, and it's interesting because the subtitle of the movie is very popular. It's made $300+ million in the first 2 weeks it's open. It says, the subtitle of it at the top, you probably can't read it, it says, "The World is Watching." And the two main characters in here, it's interesting because what happens in their life, I haven't read the book and I wasn't thrilled about the movie, but it does have a couple, I think, good teachable moments. And one of them is the two main characters, this girl and this guy, they live in this district, one of 12 districts, and there's sort of this, there is a city and it's got a whole different kind of life. And one that they really don't have any clue what it's like. And it's so different than the poverty and desperation that they live in, that they get on this train and it's so alien to anything that they have experienced. And they go into this town and it boggles their mind. They can't believe what they're seeing, that there's this whole nother reality to life that they were totally unaware of. And the thing is that other reality, that other town knows everything about them. Knows everything about their world, knows everything about who the people are and what they're going through. They're watching them. And the people, they just have a very vague sense of what that's like. And I think that's very much what life is like for us. We don't ever really see this whole other reality that's going on around us, the spirit world. People who aren't Christians very oftentimes will say, "Well, I'm a spiritual person, and I believe that there's a good force in the world that I want to be aligned with." And what's funny to me is as they would say that, I go, "Well, do you think that maybe there's an evil force in the world also?" And they go, and it's like people are very readily willing to believe that there is a good force in the world, call it whatever they want. But very often people will live in denial that there is also maybe another very real force that might impact the world also. And that's what the Bible very clearly teaches us. There is a good force, and it gives it name, and it gives it personality. It explains to us how it works. It gives us an understanding of evil, why there's evil, how it impacts us. And Jesus helps gives us an understanding of all of this whole world. And I think it's good for us to be aware that this stuff is real. This is the key. You may think you're just a material person, but the Bible says you are also a spiritual person. And you open your life to all sorts of influences. And here's the thing. These people in this town tell Jesus, go away. What do you think they're doing to the door of their spirit, to God's influence in their life, when they tell Jesus, go away? Do you understand that that's what happens in our life? We're spiritual beings, and you open yourself up to the spirit world all the time. And if you say no to one power, there's a very, very good possibility that there's another power that you will open yourself up to. Sometimes even unconsciously, and allow it to have influence over you. So here's the thing, though. Once you become aware of this, that you're a spiritual being and you connect with God, not in just a material way, but in a very spiritual way, and that there's these spiritual influences around us, I think most of us live out of balance, that we don't really understand that, and we don't plead and cling to God and ask Him to inhabit us, to allow Him to His power and authority to exercise its influence over our lives. But here's the thing. I've also seen people that go to the other extreme. And I think it's important that you are aware that you can go to the opposite end of the spectrum, where you are so influenced by this spiritual reality that it can be unhealthy. Because God doesn't tell us everything about it, about the spirit world. And I think there's a reason for that, because He doesn't want us to go nuts freaking out about it. See, there's this reality that we can spend so much time focusing and stressing out about the spiritual realm that we can have an exaggerated understanding of it. And this is where you start walking around and you think that there's a demon behind every door, every stump, everything that happens in life you think is due to demonic forces in the world. And clearly, that's not what Jesus says. That's not the only reason why there's pain and evil in the world. The second thing is about that. It says that, we can use that as an excuse. And I've heard people say this all the time, not using this exact language, but they would say, well, the devil, there's a spiritual reality and it's influenced me, and that's why I did what I did. And the problem with that is because we're disconnected from God, we've got an inclination to do what God doesn't want us to do built in. And we can use that as an excuse to just avoid personal responsibility for the ills and pain that we cause in the world and the pain that we cause in other people's lives, and go, well, it must be somebody else's fault. No, not always. In fact, more often than not, it's probably your own fault and not someone else's, not another person's, and not another spiritual influence. Demon possession in the scripture is rare. It's not something that not all of the problems, physical or otherwise, that people experience in life are as a result of demon possession. And in fact, even that word, demon possession, that idea that a demon would live inside of you, is a little bit of a misnomer, because even in this story, there's this, you might, the language in English sort of leads you to believe that there's demons living inside of the person. The language actually is more like, there are demons that are surrounding this guy that are constantly influencing his life and his choices. And it would seem that he has opened himself up to that. But that's not always the case. It seems to be a rare thing. And so as people, here's the thing. As people, you look at people's challenges in life. On the one hand, we might say there's a material, physical, chemical explanation for everything, every sort of oddity that we see in other people, and we go, it's purely biochemical. It's purely experiential, and that's why these people have these problems. The other end of that spectrum might be, you might think everything that you see in someone that is an oddity, you go, well, it's a spiritual thing. I think the reality is you understand the subtlety of what the Bible tells us. We're physical beings. And very oftentimes, things are biochemical. They are because of our experiences. And those things can cause unhealthy dysfunctions in our life, right? Absolutely. We're material beings. That stuff is all true. But we're also spiritual beings. And very oftentimes, there are spiritual forces that very well may determine these things. The wise person comes to the Bible and doesn't say it's one or the other. The wise person says, the Bible tells us there's a number. It's a nuance. There's a number. The Bible is a thinking person's thing. It doesn't just say it's this or it's that. The Bible says, you know what? It could be this. And you see in the Bible, sometimes it is this, sometimes it is this. And so we look at every situation. We deal with every situation differently. We think, we talk, we pray, we look, we listen, we talk, we examine. We don't just blame everything in one thing. We have to be aware of how we think about all of this stuff and how it influences our life. Here's the key to this whole story, I think, is that if you want to experience God's power in your life, there's no question it's a scary thing. But that's what it really means, is giving him control. Letting him drive the boat. Being willing to say, you know what, Lord, I don't know what today is going to bring. I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. But you know what? I want to experience your power. And look at what Jesus' power brings to the world. It brings rejoicing when it brings freedom to people's lives. It brings restoration and renewal. It's an amazing thing when God's power is at work in the world and through your life. But it's not an easy thing. And it might not always lead to peace and prosperity. You know, these people, they lost physical, you know, they lost money because of it. You don't know what Jesus is going to do with your life when you open yourself up to him. And that is a scary thing. And people say, well, you know, being a Christian is boring. It's just a list of rules, of do's and don'ts. And one of the things I tell people is, you know what, being a Christian's anything but boring. Because if you really are open to God's authority in your life, you ought to wake up every morning and say, I belong to you today. And Lord, I don't know what you have for me. I've got sort of my own ideas about what today's about. But help me to be aware, God, of your presence in my life and your direction. Help me to think about how I use my money today. Because I got my own ideas, but I want to know how you want me to use it. Because this money stuff that I have, it belongs to you. These talents that I have, God, they're not mine. You gave them to me. I want to know how to use them to shape the world for your good today. My time, I've got all these things set up for my agenda, but you know what, Lord? Help me be flexible enough to be able to say, I'm willing to change and adjust what I'm doing today with my schedule. Because my time, it's yours. My life is yours. Lord, I want to experience your power, and I want to be a vehicle of your power in this world where I live. That's a hard, hard thing to do. And that's, like I said, being God's people isn't something that you do 10 years ago when you prayed a prayer and you asked Jesus to come into your life. And it's not something you do because you come to church once a week, is it? This really allowing God to have authority and control in your life, it's a daily, sand-shifting, challenging thing, isn't it? Wow. People say Christianity is boring. They don't understand what it means to give your life to Jesus. It's anything but boring. It's scary, but it's also incredibly exciting. Here's the thing about this story. Don't ever forget this. It's sort of like there's a reality that we see Jesus and all of these things in this storm with this guy healing this woman. And you know, you watch a superheroes movie and you see the superhero on the screen and he's fighting these incredible odds and he's just slaying them left and right and not even working up a sweat. And you go, oh man, that's just wow. And I think there's a sense we read these stories and we go, oh Jesus, man, he's slaying everybody and everything, and there's nothing too impossible for him to deal with. And here's this guy who's naked, and he's cut, and he's messed up. His life is ruined. He's not connected to anybody. And Jesus comes in, and he takes everything, gets the guy's clothes, puts him in his right mind, helps him get physically healthy, and helps him get connected with his people again. Whoa! Jesus is amazing. You stop and you think, see, Jesus traded places with this guy, didn't he? Jesus is the one who becomes naked. He's the one who becomes cut and slashed and beaten and broken and removed from his community. Why does that happen? See, remember what all of this story is about. This whole story is about man told God, adios, I'm out of here. I'm going to go do it my own way. That's the beginning of the Bible, right? And God, ever since then, has been doing what? Come on back. Just like the townspeople that say, get out of here, Jesus. All right, I'll let you have your way. But it doesn't mean he walks away forever. God is always pursuing us. He's always loving us. He's always chased after us because he wants us to experience the fullness of life of being connected to him and being connected to other people. But don't ever make the mistake of thinking that Jesus was a superhero and it didn't cost him anything to love you and I and give us that opportunity. God, thanks for being so good to us. Thanks for this story. Thanks for what we can learn from it. And especially thanks for your love for us. Lord, let us never lose sight of what this is all about. You came into the world. You entered into all of this pain, hurt, and you didn't avoid it, but you even took it upon yourself. And you did it because you want us to be connected to you in a radical, challenging way. Help us to heed that message and not be like the people in the town and send you away. In Jesus' name, amen.